if you'd be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Paul v. City of Deer Park.
May it please the court, Mr. Chair, Ruby will present argument from petitioner regarding 5 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The issue before the court is whether in its particular application to petitioner's tract of land in the City of Deer Park, a zoning restriction to single-family residential use only and a refusal to rezone that tract to multifamily use is arbitrary and confiscatory. That issue is one of law, but it is fact-sensitive. And because it is fact-sensitive, I think it is essential to a full understanding of petitioner's position in this court to go through with the court a few of the surrounding circumstances relating to the property in issue. And I have placed up on the stand a blown-up copy of the display that's made in our in the appendix to our application. The property in question is shown crosshatched, and it is in the City of Deer Park, Texas, which, to those of you who might not be from Southeast Texas, is in the southeast quadrant of Harris County, a suburb, in effect, of Houston. It is near the Ship Channel. It is basically a bedroom community. It consists of the tract that we see here. The Ship Channel is up to the north. The Shell Refinery is just to the north of the main residential and business area of Deer Park. The Sampson Mine is just a little farther on to the east. As this, not so legibly, but it is a blow-up, and I think that there are better copies in the record, this displays the fact that the City of Deer Park is basically, to the western limits of it, fully developed. It is developed in the ordinary uses of that kind of community, basically single-family residential, some multifamily residential, commercial, and that sort of thing. In the eastern portion, it is not fully developed. And the circumstances of this particular tract were at the time in 1980 when we were talking about it, that there was a street, which is 8th Street, which stopped dead end at this tract. 13th Street came along here and stopped at the southwest corner of this tract. So there was no direct street access except by the dead end on the 8th Street. This tract is bordered on the north by a tract called Light Industrial, another tract for Light Industrial. There is a railroad which runs across the northern portion of it, and Highway 225 runs just between the Shell Refinery and the northern part of the occupied area of Deer Park. To the south of this property was vacant land. To the east of and it was limited to single-family residential. To the east of the property is more vacant land. Basically all, except at the easternmost portions, basically all limited to single-family residential use. There were very few lots and flats in the Deer Park, in which multifamily residential use was allowed. The City of Deer Park basically is closed to multifamily residential use. You have to read, or you just have to read, the claims that were made, the statements that were made in the presentation to the Planning Commission and the City Council to see what the attitude of people of Deer Park is about apartments. So what happened was, when these condemnations were filed, it was clear to Mr. Fogg that there was no way that this property could be used for single-family residential purposes. He then filed an application to have it rezoned to multifamily residential use. That application was denied at all levels. So what we had then was condemnations which were filed for the extension of 13th Street and for the construction of a drainage ditch. The drainage ditch courses through the entire eastern segment of the park, comes into the property in question at the southeast corner, goes up to the northeast corner of the lower portion, cuts across, bisecting what was formerly a unified track. It then goes to the western line and goes up the west line of the northern track, effectively cutting off the northern track from the residential area to the west. I think that fairly well states what, in a very brief fashion, would be the physical circumstances that were involved in this particular track.
Yeah, I was a little bit confused by some of the briefing. I understood Mr. Todd was saying he wanted it multi-family residential, but it seemed to me the response was saying he wanted it light industrial, like another portion of the track that he had rezoned to light industrial.
One of the things that did happen was the city voluntarily rezoned this northern part to light industrial.
And that's what the adjacent tracks on the north and east are.
Here and here to the north and
light industrial. And would that then put light industrial on those two tracks, what is their access? What gets to those lots?
They have access across the railroad tracks to Highway 225.
Now,
they don't have access inside the city of Deer Park to the residential areas in either direction.
Now, is Mr. Todd objecting to the rezoning of that northern track to light commercial?
I know.
So the only objection he has is to the green part,
yes.
Not having it be multifamily.
That's correct. Now, one of the physical factors, which is probably the most important in relation to the ability to use this property for single-family purposes, is the confluence, which you can see fairly indistinctly, but I think sufficiently so, of two pipeline easements which cross this track. These pipeline easements are for very large gas transmission lines, 30-inch, 20-inch, 16-inch, three lines and two easements. This is the only track in the city of Deer Park that is so encumbered, and it affects, as I have said, the way this property can be used, the amount of money it takes to put into position to use it for whatever purpose, for both single family or multifamily. This
those,
is the physical property distinguishes, excuse me.
Did those easements predate Mr. Todd's ownership?
That's not in the record, Your Honor, and I would guess that it probably not, because these properties were acquired by the Todd family in the 20s and 30s, there was a group of properties in this general area that were owned in co-tenantship between the Todd family and the Dwyer family. And I think the answer to your question is that they bought those prior to the plan. I want to express to the court the recognition by the petitioner that this is a very limited issue before the court, and that we have a heavy burden to carry to be able to be successful here. But I want also to emphasize that we are not talking about a limitation on our ability to prove our case simply because the ordinance is reasonably related to the health, safety, and general welfare of the community. This court has held, and the Supreme Court of the United States has held, that is a valid circumstance to sustain an ordinance of the municipality, and we recognize that. But this court has held that the test is twofold. It must be both reasonably related to the health, safety, and welfare
but it must not be arbitrary and confiscatory in its particular application. That is the issue which we have before the court. Not that it is not related reasonably to health, safety, and welfare, but that it is arbitrary and confiscatory. The plaintiff's evidence we submit is undisputed. It was undisputed because the city did not cross-examine to attempt to negate the effect of any of the testimony of plaintiff's experts, and they did not present any evidence of their own to attempt to refute any of the conclusions that were drawn by the experts. So while the plaintiff's burden is heavy, that is, we must show that reasonable minds cannot differ, we think we've satisfied that burden. We've satisfied it because we have a mass of strong evidence and a total absence of evidence on the subject from the city. That creates, we submit, the equivalent of a presumption and gives us the satisfaction of the heavy burden which we bear.
Mr. Rohde, this property has been zoned single family since the early 70s,
yes.
I guess. What authority do you have where a refusal to change the zoning is subject to challenge for being confiscatory?
Well, the problem with that, Judge, is we have no specific case. I'll be the first to say that there is no case which is on all fours on that proposition. But I think it follows as a matter of both common sense and law that if you have a zoning restriction, which in itself is confiscatory, and that's the basic question here, then a refusal to change that arbitrary and confiscatory restriction is also illegal and void. So it's based simply on the proposition that the property cannot be used for its viable economic use based on the restriction to which the city is put.
Is there an analogy that you can draw from where a governmental inaction it creates a taking? I mean, is there some other circumstance where the government refuses to take an action and then has in fact committed a taking?
I can't conceive of it standing here, Your Honor. My concept of it would be that there must be some effort by the individual so encumbered to change the status quo. Now, City of West University against Ellis involves such a situation where the property, which was just a lot in the City of West University in Harris County, was restricted to single-family use, but it was surrounded by business uses. And the owner then sought to use that property without doing anything, without trying to get any permission. He started building a commercial building on it. And the city came in and tried to stop him. So that question was then raised in that case of whether the city had the right to maintain that single-family residential restriction in the face of his effort to change that status quo.
Is there any reason why this plat can't be divided into single-family plots and economically feasible way?
The evidence, Your Honor, is that that cannot be done economically. That is the crux of the evidence that we presented.
Well, what is the reason why that can't be done? If all of it, if the tracts south of it and west of it are single family?
Well, I press this in fear. This tract here, during the time in question in 1980, was not developed. These tracts to the west were fully developed and the development had been there for years. So the circumstances, the economics, were different in the fully developed areas than they were in 1980 as to this tract. So I don't think there is a rational relationship between the fact that
other subdivisions put on years before is evidence that a subdivision could be put on in 1980 in this tract.
But what was the evidence that could not be viable as single-family residence?
Your Honor, we had an expert do a study, a feasibility study, and his thesis was, I will rely on my experience in the development of real estate, and his qualifications were stipulated. I will take every known and reasonable expense that is required to develop the property to put it in a position to realize the benefit, the potential benefit, single-family residential. And in order to do that, I will examine it on the timetable of a reasonable development. And when he did that, his first calculations demonstrated that a developer would be millions of dollars in the hole on those reasonable expenses. He then cut back the expenses, trying to make it as conservative as he possibly could. And that is detailed in our plaintiff's exhibit number one. And on a timetable, even considering a cash sale, a cash out of the tracts, of the lots, which is highly unusual because you usually have an absorption rate over several years, a cash out would, at the time the cash received, still result in a deficit. And he made the assumptions of average costs, average lot sizes, average house prices, so that he would take into consideration all of the variables applicable to this particular study. And he drew his conclusions based on that empirical study of facts that would be involved in the development of this property, and came to the unyielding conclusion that it could not be done economically.
But he also came to the conclusion that apartments would be economically feasible.
I don't think that was made a part of the trial record other than as it had been presented in a separate report by a person who did a feasibility study, particularly on the demographics for the demand for apartments. We did not get into the feasibility from the economic standpoint of putting on a multifamily residential development.
When was the City of Deer Park incorporated?
When?
Mm-hmm. How old is it?
Your Honor, I can't answer the question.
Well, when it was incorporated, did it initially have these zoning restrictions?
My understanding is that it did not. The zoning restrictions came on in the late 60s, early 70s.
Is there any property within the corporate limits that is zoned for multifamily dwellings?
There are some. They are small lots or several lots together, but no large tracts such as we have here devoted to a large-scale multifamily residential development.
There are none in that particular area?
None.
What's the purpose in restricting the city to virtually single-family dwellings?
It's to keep apartments out as one of them.
To preserve the character of the community?
That's one way of looking at it. The other way is it's trying to keep out people they regard as those who cannot and would not invest in houses, who are more transient, who cause trouble, that sort of thing. I think that's also involved.
Is that a legitimate goal?
I think not.
Why not?
It's not because, Your Honor, in this day and time, you cannot close walls around the city, first to development, and this entire segment of Deer Park has not been developed, and it's zoned single family, and you're not going to be able to build single family, or put on single family developments. It's going to remain undeveloped. Whereas if you had a multifamily development and other potential areas for multifamily development, you would continue to get them. But to put a wall around the city and say, people who live in apartment houses can't come in here, I don't think is a valid
Could they put a wall around there and say the same thing with reference to people in mobile homes? They don't want a mobile home park there?
I don't know that is a feature that has been expressed in any of the proceedings that I've seen. There are some mobile home zoned locations in the city of Deer Park, as I recall it, down in this segment down here in the lower central area. But again, not extensive. Small areas where you would have only a few mobile homes.
But the law you would have us announce would prevent them from doing that as well.
From having mobile homes?
From having a policy of no mobile home parks.
If they had a policy of no mobile home parks, I think that would be critical of it. I'm not certain that I would say that this court must announce that.
Where in proximity to this particular property do multifamily dwellings exist in Deer Park?
There are a few down in the same area.
The southern part of the
southern part
community?
Is my park down
there. Townhouses down there?
I think that those are mostly small unit apartments, like U-shaped
garden type
apartments, not of any modern origin, I should add. And another thing, there have been no rezoning applications granted, I think but one, and that was of two lots, in the entire history of this zoning ordinance in Deer Park. One only. And that, again, is indicative of the fact that they closed their walls.
There are no multifamily dwellings at all in the northern part of the...
That's my recollection of the record, Your Honor, yes.
It not infrequently happens that a piece of land can be used economically for one purpose but not for another purpose, so that if it were limited to the uneconomic purpose, you would have a situation like you have here. Is your argument that the city must always rezone for an economic purpose if it can do so?
Well, again, it depends on the application and what the particular rezoning purpose is. The city should not just rezone what it formerly had as single-family residential just to do it, without someone coming forward and expressing an interest in having it done.
No, but here, suppose the landowner said, really the best use I can make of this property is a heavy industrial site. I cannot use it for any residential purpose, so please rezone.
No, I don't say that the city must grant that kind of application, because to put a heavy industrial, even light industrial, in this immediate area, I think would do some violence to the whole theme of your park. It calls for industrial on the periphery, but residential in the center. So we're talking about one residential quality into another residential quality, not the drastic change between single-family residential and industrial. I will not ever contend that should be done simply because single-family residential is uneconomic.
Any other questions?
Isn't that preservation of the character of the community to prevent that sort of development? Aren't you conceding that preservation of the character of the community is legitimate?
It is legitimate when you are talking about a change as drastic as from residential to industrial, or residential to commercial when you are surrounded by residential. That's kind of spot zoning.
That concentrated area, a large concentrated area of multifamily dwellings would affect the character of the community?
It would certainly affect the character of the community, but I think that the city must take into consideration the fact that what they have restricted the property to cannot be used, cannot be done. And if the owner wants to make a beneficial use of the property, the city simply cannot stand in the way by restricting him to the uneconomic use that it wants. And if there is a viable use which is not so inconsistent with the character of the community, then that is precisely what the city must allow. And that's the basis and the thesis of our case.
Any other questions?
May I have some rebuttal time, since there was
You have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. William Olson, Jr. will present argument from respondent.
Thank you. There are three issues that I would like to discuss here that I believe are material to the determination of the points under consideration. The first is whether the city's single-family residential zoning classification of the Todd property constitutes an economic taking. The second one is the significance of the city's roles serving both as a condemnor and as the judge of whether or not his rezoning application should be granted. And finally, to review the trial court's holding in the condemnation proceedings relating to damage to the remainder. The validity of the city's single-family residential zoning classification is challenged by Todd solely on the basis that it constitutes an economic taking. Well, the taking cases have really been divided into three categories, the first being physical invasion or occupancy, the second one is what some have called where a piece of the title is taken or where there is a such an encumbrance upon the property it amounts to taking one of the sticks of ownership from the bundle, and the third is the economic taking cases. I believe that the cases that are really material to the determination of issues in this case are the United States Supreme Court cases of Hudson County Water Company, the Pennsylvania Coal Company, Penn Central, and the recent Lucas case. Also, I think very material to the determination of this issue from this court is the City of West University Place versus Ellis, San Antonio River Authority versus Garrett Brothers, Teague, and Turtle Rock. One thing is clear, there's not one single sentence rule, as this court said. There's no bright line of distinction between the exercise of a police power that constitutes a taking and one that does not. But instead, there's a requirement to do a careful factual analysis of the facts and circumstances of the case. There are two ingredients I think the court should look at. Number one is the character of the governmental action, and number two is the economic impact on the owner, considering his investment bank expectations. Economic taking cases, in decided cases where there has been an economic taking, the court has either held that the purpose of the regulation fails to advance a legitimate state interest, or in other words, that the means chosen to accomplish a legitimate goal doesn't substantially achieve that intended purpose, and that there is no permanent value remaining for the property when viewed as a whole. Terms such as the regulations so restrict the property as to render it wholly useless or deprived it of all viable economic use.
To what use is this property? What uses are available to this property?
Well, this property is zoned. The issue here is the limitations imposed by the zoning to single-family residential purposes.
Was the testimony of the expert undisputed? Is not economically that's not an option in this case?
It is not. It is the position of the city that the evidence in this record really as to the property containing no viable economic use is the study of what's commonly called a record of Atkins study. This engineer took some assumptions. He took what a research firm had provided him was the most marketable home in Deer Park, which was what was called a track home, a FHA home, a home from $60,000 to $75,000. He took that price home, which had an average lot size, and according to the study, at a price range of $10,300 to $10,700. Engineering study simply calculated what the income side of the ledger would be by multiplying times just that type of development only, and then factored out the cost of development, taking into consideration pipelines and other things, and concluded that this would not be a profitable venture. Well, there's no testimony in the record that no single-family residential type of development permitted under this zoning classification could be economically developed. It's just not in the record. Also, in the most important piece of
evidence. You're saying if the expert had assumed a higher unit value for these homes in the $100,000 range it was mentioned, well, that it would have been an economically viable use for single-family residences?
There's certainly no evidence that if you assumed other types of developments, and surely there are other types of developments with a lot size for a $60,000 to $70,000 home in Deer Park, the evidence isn't clear on whether or not a $100,000 home or any other range of permitted uses in the, under the zoning classification could be developed profitably. There's no evidence to that.
Does that beg the question, sort of? I mean, if you start with a marketing study that says these are the type of homes that will sell, then how do you get to the step of saying, well, gee, Judge, you can't, I mean, I know that's what they say, but the fact of the matter is, you might be able to sell a $500,000 home here. So they haven't proven it's not feasible. I mean, what other basis upon which a developer would develop land does he make that decision except by way of a marketing study?
Well, but if you are going to accept the testimony that one particular development cannot be economically developed, it does not follow that another one might be. I don't know the answer to that, John. But
I think the answer is a marketing study, and they said this is, if you got single-family residents, and the marketing study says a $70,000 house is what is most likely to sell here, then I think you're kind of saying, well, Judge, they could build $500,000. Well, that's not the point. The point is they couldn't sell a $500,000 house.
Well, as the Court of Appeals said in its opinion, which I believe is correct, it's incumbent, the duty upon, it's a burden upon the person challenging this argument that they're taking to establish that any and all single-family residential uses would not be economically viable.
But, was that evidence disputed? That's what I don't understand. My impression was that they called an expert and you did not, and they contend there was no conflicting evidence.
There was no rebuttal to that evidence. I mean, that's the only evidence that there's not an expert put on in that regard, but that's not the most important evidentiary factor in this question, in my opinion. Todd put on an appraiser who testified as to the market value of the property. He testified to the value of the property in the subdivision at the time of the condemnations, which was the same time as the allegation that it constituted a deprivation of all economically viable use, that it was worth $7,000 an acre. And under the definitions, his definitions of market value and highest and best use, it had to take into consideration factors such as the feasibility. I mean, that's within this court's definition of market value, feasibility.
Was that as single-family residence or
yes,
as multifamily?
No, he assumed properly so that the property was legally restricted to single-family residential. And, of course, he couldn't assume any higher use because the record was pretty clear that their request for multifamily designation would not be granted. So he used the single-family residential classification, valued the property at $7,000 an acre. I mean, he used comparables. And in these comparables, he should, I mean, I'm sure he did, made adjustments to make it comparable to this particular property. But the end result was that this property carried a value of $7,000 an acre.
If you could not economically develop this property for a single-family use, would that be a taking?
Well, Governor, I believe the law to be, surely any taking case is a balancing case in a sense, the test of reasonableness, as this court has said. And I think the law in this case should be that we first consider the governmental action involved. Well, Todd does not question the legitimacy of this governmental action. This is a situation where we had property.
He does with respect to your point, too.
He does with respect, and he does, he challenges it as a valid exercise of police power on the basis it's confiscatory.
Well, and he also says you're doing it to try to get an advantage in the condemnation.
Right. That's correct. But as far as the rule of law that I believe should apply in this case, taking in consideration the legitimacy of the governmental action, is not contested. You know, it's a property that was zoned single-family residential for years. This is not a typical case where you have someone that buys property with unrestricted use or less restricted use. The city comes in and imposes a greater restriction. This is a circumstance in which this property has been under this single-family residential classification for a long period of time.
Does his ownership precede that?
Yes, sir. I believe it does. And the record, I think the zoning ordinance was adopted in 1971. And there's evidence that's been in the top.
That seems to cut against your His ownership preceded.
What I mean by that, by my point, Your Honor, is that the you know, there's not a sudden imposition of a regulation that has a dramatic impact on value. This is something that's been floating along under this single-family residential classification for some period of time. That there's testimony that Todd or any of his representatives participated in the development of the master plan. The record also is full of information about why this property should not be multifamily. There's a lot of information produced at both the planning and zoning and city council about that. But back to what the rule of law should be, if there is a legitimate public purpose behind the governmental action, and it is a legitimate means to achieve the goal intended, then I believe there has to be a diminution to the point where the property is rendered wholly useless or deprived of all viable economic use. I think that's what the rule of law should be as it applies to this case.
If you cannot develop it for single family use without spending more than you can get for it, isn't that no economic viability?
Well, the only qualification I'd put there, I agree with that. That's right. I think if the evidence supported a finding, or actually this is the situation where Todd has deferred to the status, there's no evidence to support the finding or failure to find that it was rendered wholly useless or the implied finding that it was rendered wholly useless. He also must establish as a matter of law that it is. And this record won't support that. If it did, then there may be a taking. The only qualification I would have to that is that you have to factor into this thing what the investment-backed expectations of the owner are. And it's uncomfortable that this property is held for investment purposes. So, I mean, that, to me, it fits right in with the $7,000 an acre value. Even if there was because of the restriction, an impact on the availability to develop it for single-family residential, it still carries an investment value of at least $7,000. It either is developable or carries an investment value of $7,000.
What about your second point?
I believe that, well, first of all, I think that it's incumbent upon Todd to prove that there was no evidence to support the trial court's finding Second point being the significance of the city's role as a conduit nor and as a decision maker over the rezoning request. It's clear in this case that there is no evidence of any such ill intent or bad faith on the part of city council.
The fact of the matter is, though, that the city did pay less by not rezoning it than it would have paid if it had.
Absolutely, that's correct, sir.
So they had an altruistic motive in doing it. Is that right?
Well, I can't tell you what the motives of the city council were. I think that in any circumstance where government has to deal with has to wear more than one hat, then you always have that risk. I mean, that's true. And there is significance to whether or not a governing body that's sitting in this dual role in this type of a case has acted with ill intent or to put the heavy thumb of government on this situation to lower the value or keep the value down. But there's absent any evidence, I don't believe that this court that it should make any significance.
What would that evidence be?
We had the situations in Garrett Brothers and Westgate where, I mean, it was clear that part of the intent and purpose in those cases, were to slow down that was some evidence that there was a purpose or intent behind it, either to not let the property go forward in development to retain a lower value or to, or maybe bad faith. And I believe there's a necessity of such a finding before this factor can be weighed in. This ought to be weighed, in my view, in the first tier of the inquiry in a taking case, and that is the legitimacy of the governmental action. If it is ill-intended, if it is an evil intent or ill-intended or bad faith, then it ought to be factored in that part of the equation. But here, not only is there no evidence of any such intent, the evidence really overwhelmingly supports cities leaving the property zone to single-family residential. All of the input
by the various governmental officials about the impact of apartments on the master plan of the community and the disruption of the necessary municipal services, the strain on municipal services, really supports the conclusion that there was not any, you know, any bad faith or any ill intent sitting in this, sitting here judging both of these matters. So it is our position that under the facts and circumstances of this case, there's no significance to the city's dual role as a condominor and as a legislature over the zoning issue.
You do concede that under a hypothetical set of circumstances there could be significance. You
Absolutely. I mean, I believe and I certainly think that government having the ability to you know, impact value or adversely impact value should not be able to use that ability to its own advantage. I mean, there may be some circumstances where, you know, that, well, there may not be a taking. I'm not claiming that necessarily results in a taking, but it certainly is something that is a significant in evaluating this overall equation of what the taking has occurred.
Mr. Olson, have you acquainted with yourself with State v. Ostex and State v. Schmidt, a recent writing?
Yes, sir.
Is there anything in those cases that impacts this case?
See, that really leads to the final issue, Your Honor, and that is the reviewing the trial court's finding there was no evidence of the remainder resulting from the condemnation of the street in this drainage right-of-way. And I think the significance of Schmidt here is that, you know, we have the TIG saying that unless, I mean, we're talking about a denial. In essence, the Frazier testified that because there was a severance of an open single track, that he would, the top expert testified, he would put a bridge in there, and he figured the damage to the remainder was value of the bridge, $105,000. That's in the report, Exhibit 1. You know, so the issue is under TIG, we know that there's an uncompensable, or it's not compensable taking unless there is a deprivation of reasonable access, or as that rule was modified, to unless access to material and substantially impaired is not an element of damages. You know, we have the cases that say that circuited travel is not an element of damages. So, you know, the argument can be made that as a matter of law, in this case, there have been no material substantial interference with access, because this industrial track is different uses. There's a natural separation between the two. Bottom use is residential. There's access to the extension of 13th Street. There's some logic to not having access between the industrial and the residential uses. There are certainly disadvantages potentially of that. The industrial track has access to 225. But in Smith, this court went to the point and said we're reluctant to hold such damages can never be recovered. And this may be a case in which to discuss that point. But, you know, I believe that it would make sound reason that in this case there was no damage. This is not a compensable damage to the remainder because there has been no substantial material impairment access. But there is one other point in that matter. And that point really relates to an evidentiary point, because the trial court found that there was no damage to the remainder. And therefore, it is incumbent upon TOP here to prove that there is, or to establish that there is no evidence that supports the trial court's finding of no damage, and further, by the evidence, conclusively establish that there was damage to the remainder. Now, reviewing only the evidence of the city from the city's perspective and the reasonable inferences that support the finding of no damage, we believe the trial court's finding must be affirmed. If you look at the testimony of the appraiser put on by the city, Donald Ford, he testified that before the taking, that the property had a value of $5,500 to
possibly $6,000 per acre. He testified that as to the value of the remainder, it carried a value of $7,000 an acre. This is it.
The remainder, the northern portion, is that what we're talking about?
The only evidence offered by either witness valued both tracts for single family residential purposes. The report offered by the owner testified that the value of the remainder, the 88 acres after you take out the ditch, was valued $7,000.
So that included both the north and the south?
Yes, sir. He then concluded that he thought the damage ought to be reflected in the cost of restoring access between the two tracks, which he calculated the cost of the bridge would be $105,000.
The only way you could have, under the undisputed facts of this case, the only way you could not have any damage to that remainder, which is the northern portion, as I see it, is to have it rezoned to light industrial, so it makes sense to have access from the highway.
Well, it is a light industrial. That's
the only way you have no damage to that portion of the property.
Well, this property is zoned light industrial. Has been zoned light industrial. That's in the record. I don't know.
Since long before any of this rezoning came up?
Actually, the record says that when the city went to Mr. Tall and asked him to dedicate these various right-of-ways and try to convince him of the benefits of it, there was a recommendation made to the city that he consider rezoning to light industrial on the belief that Tall would convey the easement. And Tall did not convey the easement, but the undisputed testimony of the city attorney that went to Tall thought he was going to recommend the city. The city would reconsider rezoning it. If they did, would he convey the easements? They went to the city. The city went to the zoning rehearing process on its own initiative, not on application, and rezoned the property to light industrial.
Don't you agree that but for the northern portion being rezoned light industrial, there would be significant damage to that portion because it's entirely cut off from the residential area of the city?
But for zoning is
light industrial, there would be significant damage.
Right. I think that it obviously would be significant in determination whether or not their denial is substantial or an impairment of access. I agree. Because if they were the same use, it might be different. But they're not. And they, there is logic to them having the ease of their own separate means of access and not having them between each other. It's obvious from the testimony of the city's expert that he thought that there was no damage to the remainder, that actually there was a $1,500 enhancement value caused by the improvements. He testified that the drainage ditch would be a natural barrier and that to put the two together would be a hazard. In Tom's brief, they represent that the city's expert agreed that the bridge was an appropriate measure of damage. I think if you read that testimony, that's not the case. That Ford was responding to a hypothetical question which assumed different facts and circumstances than present in this case. And the substance, really, of his testimony was that the bridge might be considered as an element of damage if it was necessary and desirable, but he didn't think it was necessary and desirable, so he didn't include it as a measure of damage or as a damage to the remainder.
Did you offer any evidence to support the Court of Appeals' conclusion that the trial court's implied finding of no damages could be sustained on the theory that special benefit was conferred by the construction of the ditch?
There was evidence presented at trial that related. First of all, we have the testimony of Ford, the city's appraiser, who testified that it had the floor value 55 to a max of 6,000 and after 7,000, which indicates an enhancement in value because this track had no access.
And that was attributed to the construction of the ditch?
Yes, sir. I'm saying the enhancements not only took it out under your floodplain and put it in a 500-year floodplain, relieved it of those restrictions of development, but it also provides access to the residential portion through the development of 13th Street, and it also removed the property from the floodplain. Plus, we have the testimony of the witness from Ford that there was an actual dollar, you know, something from $1,000 to $1,500 per acre, $1,500 of enhancement.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
Hey, please, before I have to move very quickly. First, there is no requirement that we must disprove all other possible uses. That amounts to a beyond a shadow of a doubt standard of proof, and that is simply not required in this kind of case or any other case other than criminal cases. Second, the appraisal testimony of $7,000 an acre assumed, as it must have assumed under the ethical standards required of appraisers, that the property could be developed for single-family residential purposes. He was obligated to assume that it could be developed. Therefore, there is in the record his testimony, our appraiser's testimony, that $7,000 was the value for single-family residential purposes. But we're not talking about the same two kinds of taking criteria. One is a taking by deprivation of economic value. That's the case involving the application for rezoning. The second is their condemnation of our property. The $7,000 valuation is relevant to the condemnation taking analysis. It is not relevant to the taking by economic deprivation analysis.
What was the difference in population if it was developed as single family or multifamily? How many multifamily units?
I don't know that that was developed. There were some estimates that this would bring in another 3,000 people in apartments, but I don't know that there was a comparable estimate for single-family residents. That was some of the estimates.
And there is nothing in the record as to how many single families.
Other than Mr. Atkinson's determination that there were 200 possible lots for residential purposes, single-family residential purposes, if you added, multiply that by three, a family of three, a family of five, depending on what the demographics were, you'd get a value. The governmental action.
Is there a street, north-south street, on the west side of the track there?
Right here? No, sir. No.
There's no street there, so there's no access. The access you were talking about was on the street that they condemned.
13th Street,
and we
stopped right here. The purpose of the street condemnation was to extend 13th Street.
But there'd be no access from the west?
I don't understand the question. There would be. 13th Street runs all the way through.
I'm talking about on the west side of the track.
On the west side of the track, no access of any kind to this portion of the track. No streets, no nothing. There was evidence that there was a purposeful denial of the value of the property. When the city rezoned the upper portion, the city attorney was very careful when he described that to exclude the portion of the ditch from that rezoning, in effect leaving, for instance, this little panhandle going up the west side of this track as single family residential to be valued at single family residential. When it and the dirt next to it were legitimately, I think, multi-family. So there was some evidence that there was a purposeful denial in the condemnation portion to prevent the application of a higher valuation.
Now, the zoning change to light industrial of the northern part of the tract was accomplished at the same time that the condemnation of the drain ditch took place.
I think it came, well, it was a part of the negotiations leading to the filing of the condemnations, is my recollection of the record. So part of the requirement that the city conduct settlement discussions with the landowner before filing a condemnation, that's my recollection. Right?
And the zoning as a single family was done at the same time?
No, the single family zoning had been in place since 1971. This was, all of this tract was SF1, the entire 116 acres.
But then the northern portion was rezoned, the southern portion was retained as SF1.
Mr. Rowdy, how can there be a determination that there was no damage to that northern part of that lot if it is assumed that both lots remain single-family residences? How can the trial court come to the conclusion that there is no damage?
But he couldn't. He couldn't, because a formerly unified tract was severed. And both appraisers agreed that when that happens, damages occur. So there's no way a court can conclude that there was no evidence of damage to their land. Both appraisers would have an undisputed circumstance of agreement between the appraisers. Therefore, the question is determined as a matter of law by this court. Very quickly, special benefit.
Well, you're out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments and three causes this morning. All these causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and Marshall will ask you to